Welcome to the Old Galway Diary podcast. Each week, Tom Kenny and I, Ronnie O'Gorman, write a column in the Galway Advertiser. Before it goes to press, we contact each other and share what is filling the page that particular week. This podcast is that conversation. And I would add, we enjoy talking to you and would appreciate if you would give us a rate and review on the Apple Podcast app.
Okay. Tom, good morning. Good morning.
Hello, Ronnie.
I'm not really here, Tom. I'm still far away. I just came back late last evening from an extraordinary few days I spent in a monastery, St. Catherine's Monastery, in the Sinai Desert, actually, just under Mount Sinai, where Moses received the Ten Commandments, as you immediately know. But there's this extraordinary monastery there, built in the 5th century. Imagine the 5th century. And it has survived all this time. It still has a community of 15 monks, Orthodox religion, very strongly Orthodox. And it's an absolutely magnificent place. The monastery itself is surrounded by a very high wall, which was built to protect the monks, I suppose. And yeah. Outside them is the desert, the mountain behind us, this magnificent mountain rising there. But it's quite interesting because from lots of points of view, it's not that I'm a very religious man, but I am moved by spirituality. And this was a spiritual place. There is no question. I go with the group from London under Richard Temple. Very interesting man, Tom. He sells icons and is an expert, regarded as a world expert indeed in icons. And I just called into his gallery about 30 years ago, and we got talking and we got friendly over the years. And I go with him and this group, maybe once or twice a year, we go to some place new to see icons. And this was extraordinary to see the icons here because this, I'm still very enthusiastic about it. So forgive me if I'm going on a bit. But in the 8th century, there was this thing called iconoclasm, where they decided that icons were bad and wicked and people were using them as sort of idolatry, and they must be destroyed. And they were destroyed all over the Western Church and the Eastern Church. They broke up the icons, except in Catherine's, in St. Catherine's, because it was so removed from the world in every sense. They never heard that they were suddenly forbidden. So their icons are extraordinary, including the image of Christ, the famous Sinai image of Christ, believed, Tom, to have been painted by people who knew Christ, and the description of Christ was passed down through the generations. So that has been there since the 5th and 6th century. Absolutely extraordinary. Absolutely extraordinary. So I'm still coming back slowly to reality, but you know, it was just great. You know, and it's a long way away, but the group, Richard, of course, comes with the group, and we have a very good guide, Kent Foster, really wonderful guy, Californian. And if I might say, most of us are of a certain age, Tom, and we tend to lose things. So Kent finds things before we lose them. So he's wonderful, a wonderful, friendly, interesting man in himself. But he guided us supremely well there and back. So I got in last night and I'm still there, I think.
Well, as I am considerably younger than you, not of that certain age you're speaking of, I am going to guide you back to
please do.
Galway Bay and the banks out the river. anyway, I'm delighted you had such a good trip.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, this week I am talking about music in Galway.
Oh, right. My goodness.
Yeah, it's very interesting. If you go back to the first half of the last century, there was very little musical activity in Galway. I know that the Messiah was performed in 1902 by the Galway Orchestral Society.
Yeah.
And we know that there was a group that they performed in a couple of places. There was a group known as the Technical Choral Society, which was under the baton of Clement Leeper. He was the headmaster of the technical school. And we know that Miss May Fogarty produced The Bohemian Girl and later The Pirates of Penzance. But that's all I could find.
Right.
But all of that changed, really, in November 1951. A patrician brother, a brother Cuthbert, he was asked to second a vote of thanks to Louis Evers, who had just given a lecture on Verdi to the Galway Literary Society.
Right.
And in doing so, Brother Cuthbert suggested that a choral society should be formed in the city, which would in turn foster all kinds of different types of musical activity. Now, the local papers picked up on this and it generated quite a bit of publicity. And then he was approached by the past pupils union of the patricians, whether it was the monastery school or the Bish, and asked to put together a choir that he would form from the boys of the Bish and the Mon, and that they might accompany various artists in different concerts. And so he did. They were called the Patrician Brothers Boys Choir. They actually made a 78 record in the Astaire Ballroom, which would be wonderful to hear it again. I hope there are people out there who may have somewhere this 78. I have no idea what the music was, but it was in the Astaire Ballroom. Anyway, at the same time as this was going on, there was a group known as Patrician Brothers Productions. These were Jimmy Walsh, the photographer, Sonny McLaughlin, I beg your pardon, and Charlie Donahue. And they were performing pantomimes, reviews, that kind of thing, mostly for charity. And so Brother Cuthbert decided maybe it was time to put the two kind of together, to step into the musical world, really, and as a result, the Patrician Choral Society was formed. Most of the people who came to that, to join that, on March the 5th, 1952, would have belonged to different church choirs. And then somebody suggested maybe we should bring some music in with it, some kind of an orchestra with it. And so the first rehearsal of choir and orchestra took place in this light. And in because of this new instrumental kind of aspect to the thing, it was decided to change the name of the group to the Patrician Musical Society.
And well known to
and
them.
And their first... Yes, indeed. They're not there at the moment, unfortunately. Anyway, we'll get to that. Their first performance was on May 14th of that year, a choir of 60 with 12 musicians. And then they turned their attention to a stage show, very ambitiously to a stage show. It wasn't just a show, it was an opera, high opera, Maritana. And this opened in the town hall 70 years ago this week. I remember this production well. I can't say I was there on the opening night, but I was there with my mother at some stage during the... And it made a huge impression because, first of all, opera was so unusual in Galway at the time. I can still see and hear Mary Angela Kine and Sonny Malloy and Jerry Glynn.
Wonderful.
In that. Yeah, wonderful. It was. It was quite remarkable. Now, it was very difficult for them at the beginning because the town hall was a cinema primarily. So it finished, the cinema finished on a Sunday night. And so the stage crew couldn't do anything until the audience had left that night. The cinema screen was rolled up, the sets and scenery, they had all been built elsewhere in different places. They had to be brought in by P.J. Ruan. The tabrail was carried by the men's chorus from the Taivyar, while some of the female chorus diverted the traffic. There was no dress rehearsal, but the production was a huge success. Maureen Philbin from the North was the producer, and the principals, and it's worth mentioning them, I think, Mary Angela Kine, Patty Long, Sonny Malloy, Vincent Kine, Jerry Glynn, Dolores Kelly, Tom Linsky, Raphael Ward, Patrick Mahon, Jim Slattery, and Jack Keneally. They were the principals. Dodo Courtney was the piano player, and she coached all the principals as well. Brother Cuthbert was the conductor. Noreen Warner led the orchestra. The stage management was by Brother Morris, another patrician brother, and Sean Beattie. John Mulhern painted the sets. He had a very unusual way of signing sets. Two milk bottles. He used to always paint two milk bottles somewhere on the set.
Oh, no.
Dick Kilgariff did the lights, and Peggy Grealish was the wardrobe mistress.
Right.
So the PMS, as it became known, was up and running. And boy, did it run, because for about the next 10 years, it was all high opera that they did. La Traviata, Martha, The Pirates of Ben Vance.
Fearless.
Faust,
fearless.
Carmen. Yeah, exactly. It was very ambitious and wonderful.
Yeah, very.
And then in the early 60s, they changed from opera to musical when they put on The Lily of Killarney. And almost all of the subsequent productions were actually musicals rather than operas. And they flourished for many, many years and entertained thousands, indeed, thousands and thousands of Galwegians and visitors alike. But unfortunately, when the recession hit, it put them under quite severe financial pressure. And they struggled for a number of years with productions, but eventually, several years ago, they decided to call it a day. And sadly, we do not have them anymore.
Oh.
But this on this week, 70 years ago, was that first huge, notable production. And when you think of it, they have left this remarkable legacy. Brother Cuthbert was right. The formation of a choral society was hugely important. And we have since had, you know, the Baroques, we've had Cuchtladdy. Music for Galway does a phenomenal business now, I think, in, you know. And so from a musical point of view, Galway is in a much, much healthier state now than it was 100 years ago. So that's my... And so I have a couple of photographs this week of the first and third productions, that's a great number of cast members.
Yeah. Well, indeed, Tom, they're very well known. And I recognize those names you were giving out, Jerry Glynn. My father was very fond of Jerry Glynn. He thought he had a lovely voice, and I think he had. Yes. And what I love about these amateur music associations, they tackle the grand opera fearlessly. Yes. They jump in and
exactly.
They do all kinds of wonderful things. And of course, it's brilliant. And, you know, such an experience. And the orchestra is never quite as large as the orchestras of the grand opera houses of Europe. But nevertheless, nevertheless, they battle away and sing these wonderful arias. And it's a great story. The PMS were very well known. And all my growing up years, the PMS were the, you know, were the soul of music in Galway, and there were
it was the joy,
yes,
and the enthusiasm that they which they put the thing on stage that affected the audience as well. I mean,
yes, it was
a feel good group. Really.
That's very good. And yes, and it was also a must-see event because people went to it in large numbers. I'm sure the house was sold out every time they performed because they were so popular and such demand.
Yeah. Yeah, now in today's world, it's very expensive to put on a show like that.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, and you would need all kinds of guarantees or subventions, you know. But anyway, they have
lovely.
Left us with a very rich legacy.
They really did. And this is set aside from the traditional music of which we are very famous for. But, you know, it's good to have the two strains of music almost side by side. And that's very valuable. You're right about Music for Galway. They really are phenomenal. They have done an extraordinary amount of bringing great musicians, singers and orchestras, not so much orchestra. Well, they brought the RT orchestra, but they bring groups to Galway to play and sing for us at a standard we have never seen before. World-class performers. World-class, Tom. It's so interesting that that should be available to people in Galway. It's wonderful. But I guess the PMS started all that tradition, you know, that there is an audience here. Now, we are talking years too. We need a concert hall. We need a large concert hall. Is there any news of that, Tom, at all?
No, is the answer.
No, and I think
Unfortunately.
it has been muted several times. We look to the university to provide such a facility. They have the land, and you'd imagine it could be included with some of the new buildings that they're building. I don't know, but to build a concert hall is difficult for acoustics and things like that, but it can be done. Limerick have an amazing concert hall, an amazing one,
They do, yeah.
to great credit.
Yeah.
Okay, Tom. Well, that's just great. That's and you brought me back now and landed me gently back into Galway with a musical note. So I appreciate that. Actually, I
Thank
do
you.
feel more grounded having heard that nice story. But listen, unfortunately, my story is not so nice. My story is not so gentle because I'm still on about the Mamtrasna murders and the new, not new, but a different angle that the story is being presented. Now, I quickly looked at this morning before I came into you my emails, and I'm afraid some people there are saying there's too much blood and horror in your stories at the moment. Will you, God's sake, get rid of Mamtrasna and get back to probably what Tom is talking about, something a little more gentle. And I agree, I'm sorry, the graphics are very, very severe. Last week in particular, the terrible Phoenix Park murders, the graphics are horrendous. But what I'm trying to put across is that in this year, 1882, where a series of terrible crimes committed in Galway or in Ireland, really serious murders, bloody and bloodthirsty, and culminating really, if you like, in the Mamtrasna murders, which was strangely enough, was not to do with the Land League, nor was it to do with politics. It was, Tom, something you and I will understand because we've seen it so many times, even in recent years, vicious inter-family jealousy and anger over land and sheep and things like that that really matter to these people who were really semi-starving, actually, just about surviving. So they really reacted with such viciousness. And this is what the Mamtrasna murders is about. Because on August the 17th, same year, 1882, the so-called Mamtrasna murders were. Now, it was a crime that the local police, Tom, dreaded, not only because of its horrific nature, but because of the unlikelihood that the perpetrators would ever be found. Usually in a close-knit community such as Mamtrasna, the murderers would never be revealed, at least never to the police. The local people might know. But surprisingly, the day following the murders, Anthony Joyce, a cousin of the murdered man, with his brother Johnny and his nephew Paddy, all from the nearby parish of Capanacrea, 3 miles from the murder scene, went to the police with an astonishing tale. These Joyce's, Tom, gave a sworn statement that they'd followed a crowd of men that fateful night. They saw them joined up by other men and saw them approach John Joyce's house at Mamtrasna. Hidden behind a bush, they heard the noise at the door and saw some of the men enter the house while others stayed outside. Anthony heard shouting and screaming, and he quotes, he could not distinguish the screams from the women from those of the men. Now, he named 10 men whom he alleged were out that night as follows. There was Anthony Philbin, he said, Tom Casey, Martin Joyce, Miles Joyce, Patrick Joyce, and Tom Joyce of Capanacrea. Patrick Casey, John Casey, and Michael Casey. They were all duly rounded up and brought before the magistrates at Cong and charged. Now, I skip on to the court case, which followed fast and hard. Now, don't forget, there was a huge public demand in both the UK and in Ireland that these terrible murders be brought to a conclusion as quickly as possible and that the perpetrators be found guilty and punished severely, as indeed we will see they were. So the case followed very quickly. It took place in the Green Street Courthouse in Dublin, a famous courthouse, on November the 1st. Now, the murders happened in August. We're now November the 1st, 1882, in front of a Lord Justice Barry. Acting for the defence was George O'Malley, briefed by Solicitor Henry Concannon of Tuam. Those are names people will recognise, Tom. None of whom
Yes.
spoke Irish, by the way. Their defense counsel did not speak Irish, and they were dealing with native Irish speakers. Neither did the prosecution team, led by the Attorney General William Moore Johnson. He was briefed by George Bolton, the Crown solicitor, who was determined to secure convictions, even to the extent of ignoring evidence to the contrary. But I'll tell you more about that in a moment. At the opening of the case, all Bolton had was the sworn evidence of the witnesses from Cappina Crea. He rightly doubted whether they were reliable witnesses. These Joyces were known to be deadly enemies of three of the accused, Miles Joyce, Martin Joyce and Patrick Joyce. Their lands, Tom, were practically adjacent to each other. Yet they were frequently at each other's throats, accusing each other of trespassing and sheep stealing. Bolton allowed the Cappina Creas to give their evidence to the court, but he zeroed in on Philbin and his brother-in-law, Tom Casey. Both of these men had worked in England and spoke English fluently. Philbin was not in the murder gang and knew nothing until he heard about it the following day. In fact, he was at a wake the entire night and had witnesses to prove he never left the house of the wake. But he was so terrified that he agreed to give state's evidence to become what they called in those days an approver in the parlance of the time and to verify the Cappina Crea's version of events. Now, Tom Casey was a more difficult man to turn. Especially, now don't forget, this was the policy of the English prosecution at the time, well, of the legal prosecution at the time. They rounded up prisoners, put them in jail, warned them they would hang, and really made them nervous enough to start confessing, and sometimes confessing things that weren't true at all, simply to escape the rope. But anyway, that all comes evident here in this story. Now, Tom Casey was a more difficult man to turn, especially as he was with the murder gang who went to John Joyce's house that fatal night. Bolton and his assistant Brady told him that if he wanted to save his skin, he must go along with Philbin and agree with the Cappina Crea's story. Instead, Casey began to tell them the truth about his part in the murder, but Bolton cut him short and warned him that he didn't want to hear his story. All he wanted from him was to follow Philbin into the witness box and agree with him. Casey said that he would not do that, and he was sent back to his cell. But Bolton didn't give up. On the morning of the trial, and when Philbin was called from his cell to begin the false testimony, the other nine knew he had gone to swear their lives away. Understandably, they must have despaired. A warden called out Casey's name, and when he was escorted upstairs, he was taken into the office where Bolton and Brady were seated. Bolton, now this is actual conversation. Bolton said, "Casey, this is your last chance to save your neck. Will you give evidence or not?" Casey still hesitated. "Bolton, I'll give you 20 minutes in which to make up your mind. If you don't say yes, you will be the fourth man to be put on trial and you will surely be hanged." Hesitating only a few more minutes, Casey agreed. He was shown a copy of Philbin's testimony, which, don't forget, was false, and agreed to repeat the same story. Now, Tom, first in
terrible,
the box,
terrible.
I know it's terrible, who yeah. had a reputation as a hard man, being at the heart of most of the violence and disorder that took place locally. After the third day of the trial, much of the evidence delayed as interpreters struggled with meanings and with the Irish language. And after the jury was out for only 8 minutes, Pat Joyce was found guilty and sentenced to be hanged in Galway on December 15. A template now had been laid down in that first trial, which was followed in the next two trials. A guilty verdict was handed down to Pat Casey, followed by the same verdict on Miles Joyce, an elderly man who did not appear to have the slightest knowledge, Tom, of what was being said, though he must have understood the significance of the black cap placed on Justice Barry when the dreaded sentence was passed. Now, on this stage, it must have been evident that the five remaining prisoners were doomed, despite their protestations of innocence. Their solicitor, Henry Concannon, persuaded Bolton to allow their parish priest, Father Michael McHugh, to intervene to see if he could persuade them to plead guilty, if it meant a life sentence in jail rather than hanged by the rope. Bolton agreed. He didn't care. All he wanted was, you know, to get this case over and done with and the guilty, what he imagined were guilty, put to one side to be hanged. The priest, although he believed they were innocent, he knew they were innocent, but he argued with them that even if they were guilty, a guilty plea would now save their lives. If they were innocent, he believed, the truth would be known someday. He urged them, save your lives, plead guilty. And this they did, Tom, very sadly. They each received a life sentence with hard labor. So the next, I'm stopping it there because it really is so wretched. It's so terrible that these men such crass ignorance and such determination to get a guilty plea. But it was within the context of a series of terrible murders in Ireland, and they looked upon these people as savages, or as the London Times gave it an extraordinary headline one time, an outburst of unredeemed and inexplained savagery when they murdered.
I'm afraid there was a lot of savagery from the prosecution as well.
Tom,
this was a kind of murder. I mean, it was an appalling miscarriage of justice, for which the English justice system regarded themselves as being wonderful and perfect. But it was dreadful.
Yeah. No, I'm glad you said that. There's no question about that. They did not get justice. Now, some in that mix, there were some guilty people, but I'll try and name them next week and I'll tell you who was guilty and who wasn't. According to Harrington, the MP who did an independent investigation. But you're right, Tom. The court case was a farce. The men were threatened. They were frightened. They were speaking a language they didn't understand. It's been translated. And you know, when you hear people translating, it's never quite what was said. Often in language, it's the undercurrent, it's the face expressions. These are all add, you know, to the expression of language.
They had to bring the trial to Dublin.
Yeah.
Because they were afraid of what might happen if it were held in Galway.
That's absolutely true.
That there might have been a lot of protests, etc., which I'm sure there would have been.
Absolutely.
It was awful, appalling.
But as I said, I am sorry for being so pessimistic in the story, but I was enthused by what I saw in the New York Times. Tom, we leave it anyway this week. I've spoken far too much as usual, so I will now firmly close my mouth and perhaps drift along to the music notes that you so gently gave me from the PMS Society.
Okay, thank you. Anyway, until next week.
You betcha. Take care.
Yeah. Slán.